Welcome back. Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. I don't know what just happened to my voice. It was weird though. I haven't spoken for a few hours. Sometimes I don't realize how long it's been since I've used my voice until I use my voice. And I'd say it was a while. We're talking about Book 11, Chapter 10 of The Brothers Karamazov. Did Ivan have a premonition? And how will Alyosha react to Ivan being visited by the devil? I am Norwegian, said Conscience. What conscience? I make it myself. So why do I suffer remorse from habit, from the universal human habit of 7,000 years? Divest ourselves of the habit and we be Übermensch. Crossed out the word gods for the word Übermensch. I wonder if the devil had a great big bushy mustache too. I really wonder what is going to happen at the trial now. Ivan had made his decision to do the right thing, but now he's drowning in doubt on the edge of insanity. Ted Griffith said, in the last chapter, the devil said, my friend, today I have selected a particular method which I shall explain later. I think Dostoevsky is implying something supernatural did occur, that the devil really did convey to Ivan that Smerdy had hanged himself. Be that as it may, I am reminded of the deja vu phenomena I expect all of us have had at one time or another. When we test this, it turns out to be a phenomena of our brain circuitry. Very interesting. I recommend you take a look at it. In short, we jumble the order of our memory in a very interesting way that leads to faulty chronology of events. Be that as it may, Ivan absolutely believes it. The note Smerdy left is meant for Ivan. The mentioning of free will is to torment Ivan even further. Even in death, Smerdy lingers on in Ivan's conscience. He's terribly stupid, Alyosha, terribly stupid. Ivan talks about the devil, but since the devil only used Ivan's own arguments, this shows us Ivan has changed his mind. He's been stupid. But then later he reverts back to his old bitter self-torturing self. Ivan threw the glass at the devil, a little nod to Luther's Inkwell story that I'm Norwegian mentioned yesterday. Ivan saying that tomorrow will be Calvary is the upcoming trial, right? It's interesting that he uses a religious term. Is it Calvary in all the other translations? Laura Weistich said, I interpreted it quite differently. I think Ivan believes that the devil told him about Smerdy hanging himself, but he never did. It's just more of him, his delirium. He's not being able to tell what is reality. Also, there's the line, refusing to admit a doubt, which implies he does have some doubt. But then Alyosha comes along and confirms that Smerdy hangs himself. I am Norwegian. Swim said the Mama Fishy said, ha, we only have a book and an epilogue to go. I'm ready to move on. Although I am trepidatious of where the next book will take us, we've had a lot of murder, mayhem, insanity, gothic moors, Nebraska blizzards, being adrift at sea, immersed in joy, sea, and despair. True, we've been on a bit of a trip here. I'm excited for the next one, to be honest. Look, this book, I can't imagine that the next book will be less enjoyable for me. I really haven't gotten into this book. I think you all know that by now. So I'm excited for something else. By the way, on that note, we'll start up our vote soon enough for the next book. Techrific said, it has been a journey, to say the least. I've enjoyed it, though. I've never followed a regime like this before. There's been similarities between the books. All of them, so far, have stretched the idea of what a short story novel should look like. Things that now may seem like cliché or mannered, or even trite, as was once considered new and fresh, innovative, etc. I wonder if Hemingway was trying to show the full scope of storytelling, good and bad. I guess we can learn a lot from bad writing, perhaps even more so compared to, say, Nabokov, where the prose is too good to even try to compete. I think it was either Ian McEwan, Salman Rushdie, or Martin Amis that said that after reading Nabokov, they went, why do I even bother? There are a couple of books on the list that scare me, Madame Bovary, for example, because I tried to read it once when I studied French and it was so boring I almost wept. Oh dear, don't say that. A couple of books excite me, The Red and the Black, Buddenbrook's Anna Karenina, and The American. Somerset Maugham was a writer with a very bloated reputation, but I'd like to read what is considered his best work. I read his Magician when I was young and quite liked it. Which book are you most excited about? Well, I'm excited for Anna Karenina. JMama8779 said, I may be in the minority, but I'm most excited for Anna Karenina. It might be a bit too much Russian Lit for everyone to do Dostoy, then more Tolstoy back to back. I feel that. But also, yeah, I'm excited for Anna Karenina too, because, why? Because I want to do a direct back-to-back comparison between these two, Dostoy and Tolstoy being, well, you know, the two contemporaries of Russian classic writers. They are sort of the top two, aren't they? And a lot of them, you know, it's always Tolstoy versus Dostoevsky, which one's better, which one's what. So they're always being pitted against each other, and I just think it would be interesting to read them back-to-back. I'm also excited for The Red and the Black. I know nothing about it, but the title excites me. weirdly enough. And there's one called The Enormous Room, which also excites me just by the title, because it seems like it'll be simplistic. Just going by the name of the name of the book, I think it might be not too convoluted and confusing, but that is literally judging a book by its title, so I have no idea. But those are the ones that are at the top of my list, curiosity-wise. Swim said, the Mama Fishy said, I would like a change of pace. I'm intrigued by the Oxford Book of English Verse, since it changes the medium to poems and covers a broad swathe of centuries. Also, Hudson's Far Away and Long Ago is a memoir set in South America. Well, that sounds good too. Again, a different medium and setting. Something short would be excellent, so Anna Karenina is out. Plus, do we really want to stay in Russia? Maybe we need a vacation. Tolstoy's War and Peace has its own subreddit, so that's a bad pick. I'm reading Les Mis with the other folks over in that subreddit, so I would pass on Madame Bovary for now. But really, whatever. Oh, is Madame Bovary related to Les Mis? Is it the same author? Who's the author? Victor Hugo? No, it's not. I'm not sure what there's a connection there, but yeah, there's some good ones. I'm excited to read most of them. The Oxford Book of Verse worries me a little bit, because I'm not sure what pace we're going to make our way through that. And I'm also just, I don't know, poetry sometimes is just a bit much to decipher. I suppose, though, in a group like this, it's the ideal place to decipher something like that. Uncle Jocelyn Mayer said, hey, not the best moment for a nervous breakdown, although I added the word hey at the start. I don't know why I did that. Ivan's detriment of health will carry consequences. Ivan could be declared mentally ill. Nobody will believe in Smurdy's guiltiness. Dmitri's escape will never take place. All right, let's move along. Move along, everybody, to Book 12, A Judicial Error, Chapter 1, The Fatal Day. At 10 o'clock in the morning of the day of the following events I have described, the trial of Dmitri Karamazov began in our district court. I hasten to emphasize the fact that I am far from esteeming myself capable of reporting all that took place at the trial in full detail, or even in the actual order of events. I imagine that to mention everything with full explanation would fill a volume, even a very large one, and so I trust I may not be reproached for confining myself to what struck me. I may have selected, as of most interest, what was of secondary importance, and may have omitted the most prominent and essential details, but I see I shall do better not to apologize. I will do my best, and the reader will see for himself that I have done all I can. And to begin with, before entering the court, I will mention what surprised me on that day. Indeed, as it appeared later, everyone was surprised at it too. We all knew that the affair had aroused great interest, that everyone was burning with impatience for the trial to begin, that it had been a subject of talk, conjecture, exclamation, and surmise for the last 2 months in local society. Everyone knew, too, that the case had become known throughout Russia, but yet we had not imagined that it had aroused such intense interest in everyone, not only among ourselves, but all over Russia. This became evident at the trial this day. Visitors had arrived not only from the chief town of our province, but from several other Russian towns, as well as from Moscow and Petersburg. Among them were lawyers, ladies, and even several distinguished personages. Every ticket of admission had been snatched up. A special place behind the table at which the three judges sat was set apart for the most distinguished and important of the men visitors. A row of armchairs had been placed there, something exceptional, which had never been allowed before. A large proportion, not less than half of the public, were ladies. There was such a large number of lawyers from all parts that they did not know where to seat them, for every ticket had long since been eagerly sought for and distributed. I saw at the end of the room behind the platform a special partition hurriedly put up, behind which all these lawyers were admitted, and they thought themselves lucky to have standing room there, for all chairs had been removed for the sake of space, and the crowd behind the partition stood throughout the case closely packed, shoulder to shoulder. Some of the ladies, especially those who came from a distance, made their appearance in the gallery very smartly dressed, but the majority of the ladies were oblivious even of dress. Their faces betrayed hysterical, intense, almost morbid curiosity. A peculiar fact, established afterwards by many observations, was that almost all the ladies, or at least the vast majority of them, were on Mitch's side and in favour of his being acquitted. This was perhaps chiefly owing to his reputation as a conqueror of female hearts. It was known that two women since when? Where's that little detail came from? What the hell is that talking about? This was perhaps chiefly owing to his reputation as a conqueror of female hearts. That's literally the first we've heard of that in this novel. Okay. It was known that two women rivals were to appear in the case. One of them, Katerina Ivanovna, was an object of general interest. All sorts of extraordinary tales were told about her, amazing anecdotes of her passion for Mitya in spite of his crime, her 10-minute-old passion, because wasn't she just in love with his dad? Like a few chapters ago, who got murdered, and she's like, oh, the dad got murdered. I suppose I love the son now. This book makes no sense. Where am I up to? God damn it, I've lost my spot. Oh, it's like this shit isn't going for long enough. Her pride and aristocratic connections were particularly insisted upon. She had called upon scarcely anyone in the town. People said she intended to petition the government for leave to accompany the criminal to Siberia and to be married to him somewhere in the mines. The appearance of Grushenka in court was awaited with no less impatience. The public was looking forward with anxious curiosity to the meeting of the two rivals, the proud aristocratic girl and the hetaira. But Grushenka was a more familiar figure to the ladies of the district than Katerina Ivanovna. They had already seen the woman who had ruined Fyodor Pavlovich and his unhappy son, and all, almost without exception, wondered how father and son could be so in love with such a very common, ordinary Russian girl who was not even pretty. In brief, there was a great deal of talk. I know for a fact that there were several serious family quarrels on Mitch's account in our town. Many ladies quarrelled violently with their husbands over differences of opinion about the dreadful case, and it was that the husbands of these ladies, far from being favourably disposed to the prisoner, should enter the court bitterly prejudiced against him. In fact, one may say pretty certainly that the masculine, as distinguished from the feminine, part of the audience was biased against the prisoner. There were numbers of severe, frowning, even vindictive faces. Mitya, indeed, had managed to offend many people during his stay in the town. Some of the visitors were, of course, in excellent spirits and quite unconcerned as to the fate of Mitya personally, but all were interested in the trial, and the majority of the men were certainly hoping for the conviction of the criminal, except perhaps the lawyers, who were more interested in the legal than the moral aspect of the case. Everybody was excited at the presence of the celebrated lawyer Fetyukovich. His talent was well known, and this was not the first time he had defended notorious criminal cases in the provinces, and if he defended them, such cases became celebrated and long remembered all over Russia. There were stories, too, about our prosecutor and about the president of the court. It was said that Ippolit Kirillovich was in a tremor at meeting Fetyukovich, and that they had been enemies from the beginning of their careers in Petersburg, that though our sensitive prosecutor, who always considered that he had been aggrieved by someone in Petersburg because his talents had not been properly appreciated, was keenly excited over the Karamazov case, and was even dreaming of rebuilding his flagging fortunes by means of it. Fetyukovich, they said, was his one anxiety, but these rumours were not just, quite just. Our prosecutor was not one of those men who lose heart in the face of danger. On the contrary, his self-confidence increased with the increase of danger. It must be noted that our prosecutor was, in general, too hasty and morbidly impressionable. He would put his whole soul into some case and work at it as though his whole fate and his whole fortune depended on its result. This was the subject of some ridicule in the legal world, just by this characteristic our prosecutor had gained a wider notoriety than could have been expected from his modest position. People laughed particularly at his passion for psychology. In my opinion, they were wrong, and our prosecutor was, I believe, a character of greater depth than was generally supposed. But with his delicate health, and he had failed to make his mark on at the outset of his career, and had never made up for it later. As for the president of the court, I could only say that he was a humane and cultured man who had a practical knowledge of his work and progressive views. He was rather ambitious, but did not concern himself greatly about his future career. The great aim of his life was to be a man of advanced ideas. He was, too, a man of connections and property. He felt, as we learned afterwards, rather strongly about the Karamazov case, but from a social, not from a personal standpoint. He was interested in it as a social phenomenon, in its classification and its character as a product of our social conditions, as typical of the national character, and so on and so on. His attitude to the personal aspect of the case, to its tragic significance and the persons involved in it, including the prisoner, was rather indifferent and abstract, as was perhaps fitting indeed. The court was packed and overflowing long before the judges made their appearance. Our court is the best hall in the town, spacious, lofty, and good for sound. On the right of the judges, who were on a raised platform, a table and two rows of chairs had been put ready for the jury. On the left was the place for the prisoner and the counsel for the defence. In the middle of the court, near the judges, was a table with the material proofs. On it lay Fyodor Pavlovich's white silk dressing gown stained with blood. The fatal brass pestle with which the supposed murder had been committed, Mitch's shirt with a blood-stained sleeve, his coat stained with blood in patches over the pocket in which he had put his handkerchief, the handkerchief itself stiff with blood and by now quite yellow, the pistol loaded by Mitch at Perhotin with a view of to suicide and taken from him on the sly at Mokrovy by Trifon Borisovich, the envelope in which the 3,000 rubles had been put ready for Grushenka, the narrow pink ribbon with which it had been tied, and many other articles I don't remember. In the body of the hall at some distance came the seats for the public, but in front of the balustrade a few chairs had been placed for witnesses who remained in the court after giving their evidence. At 10 o'clock the three judges arrived, the president, one honorary justice of the peace, and one other. The prosecutor, of course, entered immediately after. The president was a short, stout, thick-set man of 50 with a dyspeptic complexion, dark hair turning grey and cut short, and a red ribbon of what order I don't remember. The prosecutor struck me and the others too as looking particularly pale, almost green. His face seemed to have grown suddenly thinner, perhaps in a single night, and I had seen him look as usual only 2 days before. The president began with asking the court whether all the jury were present, but I see I can't go on like this, partly because some things I did not hear, others I did not notice, and others I have forgotten, but most of all because, as I have said before, I have literally no time or space to mention everything that was said and done. I only know that neither side objected to very many of the jurymen. I remember the 12 jurymen, 4 were petty officials of the town, 2 were merchants, and 6 peasants and artisans of the town. I remember long before the trial, questions were continually asked, with some surprise, especially by ladies. Can such a delicate, complex, and psychological case be submitted for decision by petty officials and even peasants? And what can an official, still more a peasant, understand in such an affair? All the 4 officials in the jury were, in fact, men of no consequence and of low rank. Except one, who was rather younger, they were grey-headed men, little known in society, who had vegetated on a pitiful salary, and who probably had elderly, unpresentable wives and crowds of children, perhaps even without shoes and stockings. At most, they spent their leisure over cards, and of course had never read a single book. The 2 merchants looked respectable, but were strangely silent and stolid. One of them was close-shaven and was dressed in European style. The other had a small grey beard and wore a red ribbon with some sort of medal upon it on his neck. There is no need to speak of the artisans and the peasants. The artisans of Skoto-Prigonoyevsk are almost peasants, and even work on the land. Two of them also wore European dress, and perhaps for that reason were dirtier and more uninviting looking than the others, so that one might well wonder, as I did as soon as I had looked at them, what men like that could possibly make of such a case. Yet their faces made a strangely imposing, almost menacing impression. They were stern and frowning. At last the president opened the case of the murder of Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov. I don't quite remember how he described him. The court usher was told to bring in the prisoner, and Mitya made his appearance. There was a hush through the court. One could have heard a fly. I don't know how it was with others, but Mitya made a most unfavourable impression on me. He looked an awful dandy in a brand new frock coat. I heard afterwards that he had ordered it in Moscow expressly for the occasion from his own tailor, and had his measure. Who had his measure? He wore immaculate black kid gloves and exquisite linen. He walked in with his yard-long strides, looking stiffly straight in front of him, and sat down in his place with a most unperturbed air. At the same moment, the counsel for defence, the celebrated Fetyukovich, entered and sort of subdued hum passed through the court. He was a tall, spare man with long, thin legs, with extremely long, thin, pale fingers, clean-shaven, demurely brushed, rather short hair and thin lips, and that were at times curved into something between a sneer and a smile. He looked about 40. His face would have been pleasant if it had not been for his eyes, which, in themselves small and inexpressive, were set remarkably close together, with only the thin, long nose as a dividing line between them. In fact, there was something strikingly bird-like about his face. He was in evening dress and white tie. I remember the president's first questions to Mitya about his name, his calling, and so on. Mitya answered sharply, and his voice was so unexpectedly loud that it made the president start and look at the prisoner with surprise. Then followed a list of persons who were to take part in the proceedings, that is, of the witness and experts. It was a long list. Four of the witnesses were not present. Musov, who had given evidence at the preliminary inquiry, but was now in Paris. Madame Holokov and Maximov, who were absent through illness, and Smerdyakov through his sudden death, of which an official statement from the police was presented. The news of Smerdyakov's death produced a sudden air and whisper in the court. Many of the audience, of course, had not heard of the sudden suicide. What struck people most was Mitch's sudden outburst. As soon as the statement of Smerdyakov's death was made, he cried out aloud from his place. He was a dog and died like a dog. I remember how his counsel rushed to him, and how the president addressed him, threatening to take stern measures if such an irregularity were repeated. Mitya nodded in a subdued voice, repeated several times abruptly to his counsel, with no show of regret, "I won't again, I won't, it escaped me, I won't do it again." And of course, this brief episode did him no good, with the jury or the public. His character was displayed, and it spoke for itself. It was under the influence of this incident that the opening statement was read. It was rather short, but circumstantial. It only stated the chief reasons why they had been arrested, why he must be tried, and so on. Yet it made a great impression on me. The clerk read it loudly and distinctly. The whole tragedy was suddenly unfolded before us, concentrated in bold relief in a fatal and pitiless light. I remember how immediately after it had been read, the president asked Mitya in a loud, impressive voice, "Prisoner, do you plead guilty?" Mitya suddenly rose from his seat. "I plead guilty to drunkenness and dissipation," he exclaimed, again in a startling, almost frenzied voice, "to idleness and debauchery. I meant to become an honest man for good just at the moment when I was struck down by fate, but I am not guilty of the death of that old man, my enemy, and my father. No, no, I am not guilty of robbing him. I could not be. Dmitri Karamazov is a scoundrel, but not a thief." He sat down again, visibly trembling all over. The president again, briefly but impressively, admonished him to answer only what was asked and not to go off into irrelevant direct exclamations. Then he ordered the case to proceed. All the witnesses were led up to take the oath. Then I saw them all together. The brothers of the prisoner were, however, allowed to give evidence without taking the oath. After an exhortation from the priest and the president, the witnesses were led away and were made to sit as far as possible apart from one another. Then they began calling them up one by one. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. Have your say on the subreddit. Thank you very much for listening today, and I'll see you tomorrow.